Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Here we go, and the Media Project is underway. I'm Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York. Thank you for joining us. With me this week is Alan Chartuck, who happens to be at a remote location, and he can explain why in a couple of minutes. Alan, of course, is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, and publisher of the Legislative Gazette. And also here is Judy Patrick, the editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. Welcome, Judy.
It's always good to be here.
Nice to see you. We don't see Alan. I'm not, what shall I say? It's not nice to see Alan. How will that come out? Alan is not here and we can't see him.
Yes, and we will miss his facial expressions because they do add a lot to our conversation.
Well, it's hard to anticipate what he may be saying and what he may be angry at when you can't see him, although I think after all this time we sort of know what will touch his buttons, so we'll anticipate it even out without seeing him. And why, Alan, are you not joining us and you are somewhere in the greater Manhattan area today?
That's because we have a new entry into the world, our first grandchild, who has entered the world about 12:35 last night.
As we speak. That would be Thursday morning.
That's right. And it's going to be a terrific addition. There's already hell to pay.
And how's that? It's too soon. No,
all kinds of rules being...
Oh, well, you get used to it. I have two grandchildren, and you know that as a grandparent, there is a great joy, but not as much responsibility. So you sort of just listen to what the parents want you to do and stay out of the way.
And having fun this week, WAMC has a roundtable program, and we were discussing the way in which people dress. And our Judy Patrick, who is with us today and was there, and a lot of people were writing in and talking about the sexualization of American youth. And I asked Judy how she dressed. Here's how come the Media Project is involved. How she dressed when she went into the newsroom. And she said...
I dress conservatively when I go to work, but on the weekends, I do not dress conservative. I mean, I dress... here I go again. I dress in T-shirts and shorts.
On the weekends.
Yes, but in my office, I am professional. Yeah. But, you know, nowadays, the younger reporters, they don't wear suits and ties anymore, and I've gotten to be a little bit more tolerant of that.
You know, it's interesting, and it applies to newspapers because that's my frame of reference and Judy's. It applies to all businesses in one way or another, but I used to be a tie guy every day, and then all of a sudden the mores have sort of changed, and in the last couple of years before I left the company, I was not wearing a tie every day, and long before that, we had young reporters who would have normally worn what we would both describe as business attire. They started showing up in T-shirts. And it was a concern because, we have a union shop and it's hard to apply what you would like to say within the union contract. But we basically said, wear something that's appropriate for your job. And we hope that the sanity will prevail. But it is much more casual. And now, Alan, you wear a tie every day.
I do. I was on television for a lot of years, and every night I would do political commentary on one of the two networks around. And so I began to buy wild ties,
yeah,
or ties that made a statement. And I would go on every night, and I would talk about something political, and I would get all this mail about my ties. So I ended up understanding what Rex would always refer to as the golly gee whiz, Martha. It's not... Golly gee whiz, did you hear what he said? It's golly gee whiz, look at that tie. I have about 500 ties.
But we try to impress upon our people that if you're a reporter, and certainly if you're an advertising salesperson, you're out in the street representing the company and you want to look professional. But the question in these days, as the world turns, is the definition of professional has changed. And so what people can get away with today is a lot different than what would have been certainly when I started in the business.
You know, I've had occasions where I've wanted to send a photographer or a reporter to a funeral, for example, and I look at what they're wearing and I'm saying, no, I can't send that reporter today to that funeral.
Well, you know where I actually think it changed in the newspaper business, and you're going to call me crazy, but if you remember the old Lou Grant show.
I was just going to say that.
And they had a character whose name was Animal. He was a photographer.
Animal.
Because even the photographers looked quote-unquote professional in the old days. I just thought that was the tipping point for the newspaper business.
Well, for those people who are young and listening, Animal wore basically war garb.
Yeah.
He was really disgusting, and everybody loved Animal. And so you're right. But, you know, Ira, just before we go on, I have to tell you that we walked in to buy a little grandchild present to one of the stores, actually for his mother. And I said, how come there's one of these places in Great Barrington, a wonderful store, named Seeds? And we walked in, and I said to the wonderful lady, Robin, who runs it, I said, how come there's nothing for men in here? She said, men don't shop.
Well, I have a recommendation. I have a recommendation for the station in my role as observer and a board member. But with the fund drive coming up not all that far away, I think you should have a premium of a WAMC onesie. And if you don't know what a onesie is yet, you'll learn very quickly. So
I do not.
Oh, you do not. I'll explain that to you later. Let's get on to some real news. How about... real media news. How about the guy who works for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a carpenter who has quit his job because the owner of the company, which is Lee Enterprise, their CEO, recently received a $700,000 bonus, all of which, of course, is occurring at a time when Lee, and as well as so many other companies in the industry, are cutting back and laying off and et cetera. And here, Mary Junk, who's very well known in the industry, got a $700,000 bonus for refinancing the newspaper chain's debt. And so the carpenter, Scott Bujnak, just up and quit. Do we feel like he's a hero? Do we feel like he doesn't get it, that the CEO has a job and is paid commensurately with his or her duties?
Yeah, you get this in every industry where you get high-paid corporate executives and you get low-paid people. One of the lines from the story, what's the point of saving nickels and dimes when the big boss gets a $700,000 bonus? It's true. Throughout our industry, we are doing nickels and dimes, and I think it's worth discussing how much the upper echelon is getting paid and how that's affecting what the people who are writing the stories, taking the photographs, and delivering the newspapers are getting paid.
Well, I mean, Alan, I know at this station, as the station started pulling its belt in, you did as well. You set an example for the people on the staff here. And it seems to me, at the very least, bad public relations when a CEO of any company, not the least of which is the financially troubled newspaper business, you know, accepts that kind of bonus in the wake of what's going on in cutbacks, et cetera.
Well, you know, Ira, I don't deserve any kudos for my salary. I'm very happy with it. I have noticed in the papers that some of the CEOs in our industry, in some of the major markets, and we consider ourselves a pretty major market, are making $500,000 and $600,000. That's a lot of money. And then you say to yourself, okay, so where is the reaction from the staff like this guy who quit? And the answer is, I don't think anybody cares. In New York City, where a wonderful CEO makes in the middle 500s, I believe, I don't see people not giving money to WNYC. In fact, they're getting major grants. You know, the corporate extends into the not-for-profit sometime. But, you know, while people say, oh, golly, gee whiz, Martha, that they're making all that money, and I think you're exactly right, because I've never figured if you took that kind of money, why anybody would send you $25. But it apparently doesn't really work that way. This is a country that runs on money. And people understand that, and they just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's the way it is.
It just looks bad. I know the last, it's almost as many as 5 years that I was the publisher of my newspaper. I didn't get a raise every year. But then again, nobody in the company did. So why should I get one if nobody in the company did? So anyway, this guy in St. Louis, this carpenter, did what a lot of people wish they could do and said, basically, take this job and shove it and be carpentering somewhere else.
Let's hope.
Let's hope. There's an interesting First Amendment case going on This is from the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. Major news organizations have filed a friend of the court brief supporting Google and YouTube in their effort to overturn a takedown order for an anti-Muslim video that inflamed Islamic communities worldwide. If you recall, there was a video came out that insulted Muslims and in some quarters was blamed for the violence in Benghazi and the death of the U.S. ambassador there. And now a three-person panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ordered Google, which owns YouTube, to pull this video from its site. And it's partly because an actress who was featured in the video claimed she was not told of what the video was all about and that her words were dubbed in post-production. The issue is, should the courts be telling a media organization to pull down a video, or is this a free speech First Amendment issue? And it is, according to the LA Times and the Washington Post and a number of other big media organizations that have filed briefs supporting Google, YouTube in this case.
Yeah, I see this as a huge problem. Can you imagine if one person quoted in your story could have veto power and as a result have the entire story be pulled? And also, even beyond the copyright, the idea that when something is out that a court can rule that it be taken down across the board, it just seems harsh and extreme.
Alan, you agree? Does this let somebody get a foot in the door on something like this and it'll expand to the detriment of media?
I have no doubt that that's exactly what is happening in this country. None. I take a look and see all of the surveillance issues, all of the diminution of civil liberties. And I got to tell you guys, I'm not surprised, and I look forward to seeing if this gets brought to the Supreme Court, what the five conservative justices on that court have to say. Because it seems to me it fits in pretty well with the direction that the country's going in, and it is very scary. I couldn't agree with Judy more that once that foot goes in the door, and it's been increasingly so, the country is going to lose a great deal.
And we also have courts involved in other media slash business cases. You've got the net neutrality decision, which for the uninformed, I'll see if I can explain this correctly. Net neutrality essentially means that there is free and equal access to internet by everyone. And when the FCC, which attempted to get a version of that through, a federal appeals court said, no, you can't do that. So it bumped it back to the FCC. And now there's word that the FCC is going to write regulations that will favor, my phrase, big media companies, because it will enable them to pay more to get better bandwidths and better speeds. And it will be at the detriment of the average person who will not have the same wherewithal. So you have that case going on. And then the widely discussed Aereo case in the Supreme Court earlier this week, regarding a new way of people picking up television signals, which could be would be at the detriment of the big companies that distribute signals now, which are now getting considerable amount of money for them. So two other major media things that are sort of filtering their way through the courts.
You know, one of the things I think is missing from a lot of these discussions or these cases is there's really not a strong consumer advocate or average American advocate or a viewer advocate. They're always, you know, the big money interests fighting over this wonderful form of communication that's out there. And I'm not hearing a lot from the consumer side.
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, where the Ralph Naders and the other guys and now, or the contemporary Ralph Naders. Now, there is a lot of yelling about net neutrality, which is one more example of what I was just referring to, which is that this is corporate America. What do you think Citizens United, the court case, was all about, or all of the other things we see? Is this court going to rule in favor of the common Joe? The answer is no. It's going to be corporate down the line. And we're going to see that in the Aereo case. We're going to see that in net neutrality across the board. When it comes to protecting corporate rights, that comes first, and the rest of us can go, well, let's just say, downward.
It also underscores how important these judicial appointments are, and how not just the Supreme Court. We all know how, you know, the brouhaha will occur whenever there's a nominee for the Supreme Court, but the lower courts, too, have a significant amount of influence and could potentially— there is a political element to the decisions that they make and or the way that particular justices see the world. And here's a case with the net neutrality where it would seem that they are ignoring the greater good in exchange for benefiting the big moneyed interest.
You know, and from a media perspective, you also have to keep in mind that it's important for all the public to have access to good information about things that are very important to the running of our society. And if it gets to the point where, you know, that information costs a lot of money or there are barriers to getting the information because a lot of corporations are in control, then that's going to be bad for society in general because people aren't going to have good access to important information.
This is the Media Project, and I'm Ira Fussfeld with Judy Patrick and Alan Shartuck. You know, there's such a thing as Q ratings. I don't know what, Alan, do you have Q ratings in radio?
Oh, indeed we did.
You do. Okay, well, this
when
is
I,
not
when
a...
When I was on TV, we don't have them at WMC, but when I was on TV, they ran Q ratings all the time, which was basically, I think, Ira, correct me if I'm wrong, to describe whether people liked you or not.
That's my impression. It's people right. Measure how favorably you come across on the air.
Yeah.
And I think Alan's Q rating was pretty high, wasn't it?
As Alan's Q rating was Q.
You're so kind.
Yes, actually, Q is the guy from the James Bond movie, the guy who has all those phony inventions.
But I wanted to confirm what Judy said. It was high.
Well, that's from those. It was so, or you were high with those wild ties you were wearing on TV. We'll bring it all together. Well, anyway, this is not exactly a Q rating story, but it sort of is. NBC's venerable Meet the Press, which touts itself as the longest running program of all time and has always been the dominant program on Sunday morning, always is not the case anymore. It has now fallen to third place in the ratings behind CBS's Face the Nation and ABC's This Week. And apparently, not coincidentally, this is occurring after the death of Tim Russert and under the reign of David Gregory, who has been the host since Tim Russert passed away. And what NBC News has done, according to the Washington Post, it has hired a psychological consultant to talk to David Gregory's friends and family about the declining ratings of the show. And I'm not exactly sure whether they're trying to get a sense of whether he's depressed or whether, you know, what it's all about. But beyond that sort of, in my view, shocking approach to this, it speaks more towards a view that this is personality-driven versus content-driven. And what is it about the content of Meet the Press that is different, or what is it about the other programs that have made people turn to them at the expense of Meet the Press? Is it just, I mean, I guess it could be. If you don't like the host, you'll watch something else.
You know, one of the good parts of the story is the fact that those Sunday morning interview shows are still very, very popular, and they're meaty, and they're not drivel, they're not sensational. They tend to be dealing with substantial issues, although it sounds like Meet the Press has changed a lot from, you know, the show I remember where people sat around a table and debated issues, truly faced, you know, met the press. But it makes me glad I'm not in broadcast journalism.
Well, I remember Lawrence Spivak. I am a guy who is quite old. And I remember Lawrence Spivak, who I always thought of as a sort of crusty curmudgeon. And he used to be the head of it. And then all of a sudden they had him sitting as one of the members of the panel, if I remember this correctly.
Well, you do. And it was always very much a Nuremberg panel kind of a show. It was a product of the times of, you know, the early days of TV, where they essentially took radio and made it into TV. So you had a moderator, Spivak, and a couple of other people interviewing and, in effect, cross-examining someone. But it was very informative and very newsy. And it continued that way when Spivak died and they hired a guy named Bill Monroe. I don't know if you remember him.
He was a great bluegrass man.
And then I don't remember if Russert was, no, I think, was Brokaw the host at some point?
For a short time.
And then Russert came in. And of course, even then, Russert was a prosecutor. I mean, he wouldn't let these guys down. So it's interesting to me because I think I would have thought that Russert's style would have turned people off because he was so relentless that sometimes people, when you're viewing that kind of an interview, get uncomfortable and feel for the subject of the interview. But he was wildly popular. And Gregory apparently has just not touched the same chord with the viewers. And his ratings started to flail. And so they tried to tinker with the format, which is always interesting because you've got a successful format and you move from it. Now you're rolling the dice.
Well, I like Gregory. I think he's a sweet guy. I like him a lot. And I wonder what in the world they think they're doing with a psychological profile with family and friends.
Yeah.
I mean, I like them, but maybe the American people think that this is putting people in the arena to be eaten by the lions, and that that's what works. And there's a part of every human being that is dark, and that you got to chemically analyze what's going on, whether you're feeding them enough red meat.
You know, well, the network backed off on that a little bit. The reporter stuck by a story that it was a psychological consultation. The network, after the story got out, said, no, it was just a brand evaluation. They were asking brand kind of questions.
Well, I think the interesting backstory to this could be a person by the name of Betsy Fisher Martin, who was the executive producer of Meet the Press for years and years while Russert was there. And Russert always praised her to the skies. And she continued after his death. And she resigned from the position after 11 years on the job. And reportedly, her resignation was due to matters of style and substance disagreements she had with Gregory. So we don't know what's going on back there. But, you know, it's much like with NBC's Today Show, and they were number one forever. They had the famous Ann Curry incident, which turned a lot of viewers off. And now they're trying to rejigger their operation and trying to get back their mojo so that they can reclaim number one. And that's what Meet the Press is doing. But, you know, it's not much different than the newspaper business, but stuff like this makes me glad that I was a newspaper guy and not a TV guy.
Yeah, you know, but even in the newspaper business, we are trying to brand our reporters more, you know, to make them more identifiable out in the public. In the old days, they were just bylines, but now we want them to have Facebook pages and Twitter feeds and to get a little bit of their personality so they better connect with the audience. And so in that respect, I guess we're following them a bit.
And for radio, I love the idea that we reward our reporters who get out there and have an absolutely important flag on their microphone. So if the microphone is shoved in front of the guy's face and it says WAMC, say, attaboy.
I wondered about that. So there is value to that, and there, and jockeying position and having a long arm that gets right in the mouth is considered a coup for you guys.
Exactly.
Exactly. Precisely. So we'll have to see what happens there. The other interesting piece as a final note is that the number one program now is Face the Nation, which is hosted by Bob Schieffer. 77,
and he's old, and that's what I love about
him. Well, I was going to say, 77 years old, and he is not a pretty face. He is a veteran newspaper guy who went to TV, straight news, straight stuff, no bells and whistles. And that sounds to me just like what Lawrence Spivak's Meet the Press was all about.
You know, and he asked those questions with authority, too.
Yeah, you have the feeling it's like Walter Cronkite, Uncle Walter, you know. But then you really do get into the question of sexism also. You know, there can be an Uncle Walter, but Aunt who? You know, I mean, why is it that as men age, they get a certain amount of, you know, sort of brass, whatever, around them, and we say, that's good. But where are the women as they age who are so knowledgeable? You know, you could get a Helen Thomas, one of these people at some of the press conferences, but where do we have that? Am I wrong about that, Judy?
Yeah, well, Andrea Mitchell is still out there doing her job, but you're right. They don't get to sit at the table, or they don't have the job security that the men do as they age. It is a incredibly tough business for both men and women, but particularly for women as they age. I applaud any of them that have managed to hang on as long as they can. But also, let's blame the American public, because they turn away from aging women. Maybe we need to do more as a society to bolster the image of women as they get older, and to let people know that, you know, they have the experience to be able to talk effectively about the issues of the day, to ask the important questions. I think people are still, believe it or not, uncomfortable with a woman aggressively asking questions.
It seems to be changing, but much too slowly. I mean, the backups to the Sunday morning people, Nora O'Donnell on CBS, Andrea Mitchell on NBC, and Martha Raddatz on ABC. So they are now the number two people on those shows, and years ago they wouldn't even have been that. Well, we are just about out of time.
No, tell me.
It's amazing.
So,
I hope that your grandson has enjoyed his first media project, and I'm going to explain to you what a onesie is as soon as I see you. But that's all the time we have for this week. So I want to thank you all for listening to The Media Project. I'm Ira Fuswell with Judy Patrick and Alan Shartok, and we'll talk to you next week on The Media Project.
And I hope I can meet Judy on a weekend sometime.
Or I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. pull the press, pull the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's own...